It's hard to believe that we have been having in-depth weekly conversations about movies since 2011.
So many great conversations over the years about so many great movies. All that said, producing this show week after week requires a ton of work behind the scenes.
Becoming a Next Reel member gives you access to all sorts of additional and exclusive content. Plus, you're helping us keep the lights on. Just head to thenextreel.com/membership, where you can learn more about becoming a member, which costs a measly $5 a month, practically the same as one fancy coffee drink. And you get so much more.
Every month, we record a bonus episode exclusively for members. Those episodes cover movies from whatever series we're covering at the moment, or add to previous series.
Some movies we've covered that only members get to hear us discuss include The Blues Brothers,
The Russia House,
Naked Lunch,
Independence Day,
The Hot Rock,
and Relic, the better one. Plus, members get to vote on what we're going to discuss for those episodes.
We also record additional pre- and post-show content in regular episodes that only members get to hear.
Like conversations about similarly themed movies.
And answering listener questions from our live member chat.
Speaking of our live member chat, we record almost all of our episodes in Discord, where members can chat right along with us live.
Members get access to other members-only channels in our Discord community as well. On top of all that, members get all episodes a full week earlier than everyone else in a private Next Reel feed just for them that includes all the shows in the Next Reel family. The Next Reel, The Film Board,
Movies We Like, Sitting in the Dark, and more new projects on the way.
To top it all off, members don't have to listen to ads. We've already eliminated those annoying, dynamically inserted ads that, let's face it, we all hate it.
We are listening to you.
We love podcasting for a living, and those ads help to pay the bills. Now, we're counting on you, dear listener.
We promise. We aren't going back to those terrible, dynamically inserted ads that don't relate to us at all. All we ask is that you consider supporting the Next Reel family of podcasts with a membership.
Again, it's $5 per month or $55 per year. Just head to thenextreel.com/membership.
thenextreel.com/membership. Get your access to early, ad-free episodes with bonus content, member bonus episodes, and access to member channels and live streams in Discord by signing up today. I'm Pete Wright.
And I'm Andy Nelson.
Welcome to The Next Reel. When the movie ends,
our conversation begins.
Jackie Brown is over. My ass may be dumb, but I am not a dumb ass.
You have a chance to walk off with a half there in the dots. Would you take it?
Yeah.
What do a stewardess, a gunrunner, a bail bondsman, an ex-con, a federal agent, and a beach bunny have in common?
You don't come in on this thing with me. You got to be prepared to go all the way.
They're all chasing a half million in cash.
Wouldn't he miss?
Half $1 million will always miss.
Let him get the money and then just take it from him.
She's trying to play your ass against me, huh?
That was fun.
Yeah, I don't
really
hit the spot.
All right, Andy, here we are. Would you like to tell the fair listeners how enthusiastic you are about this movie?
Yeah, Jackie Brown is a film that I just feel like it just continues getting better and better every time I watch it. I mean, I enjoy what Tarantino does with his films. I have so much fun with his characters and his writing and the interesting way that he uses the language of cinema to tell his stories with jumps through time and all of that. This is the only adaptation he ever did based on Rum Punch, which was an Elmore Leonard novel, which I haven't read, so I can't speak to it. But my understanding is it hones pretty close to the story. But I don't know if it's because of that that I feel like the film really just is telling a very compelling story with characters I really enjoy and get into. I really find a strong connection between Jackie and Max Cherry as the story continues, leaving it like that final moment between the two of them is just so powerful. And it's just like a perfect and heartbreaking way to end the film. And like so many other characters that are so interesting, and Tarantino allows them all to breathe and have their moments. And also Tarantino really takes time with the film and gives the characters those beats that we don't always get in films, like when Ordell is sitting in the VW bus with Lewis and trying to figure out what happened. And you just have this slow push on his face that is like, I don't know, I timed it. It was like 23, 24 seconds, something like that. Just this slow push on Samuel L. Jackson's face, just allowing us to watch him think and try piecing things together. And you just don't always get that, especially in like heist films where a lot of directors feel like everything needs to be at these high octane, fast and furious levels. You're getting these moments to breathe and just to really revel in the characters. And so I think that's why this film for me, as much as I love everything else that Tarantino is doing in his films, like this film just is a high point for me.
Yeah, I could probably be swayed in my overall ranking. Unfortunately, you can't get me to like this movie a whole lot more because I like it a lot. I think your point about Pam Grier is so transcendent in this movie, right? The idea of giving each character this sort of room to breathe, what we get with Pam Grier is just extraordinary. I went back to find, because I believed very deeply that this movie was actually based on a TV show from the 70s, and it wasn't, and I was wrong, but I spent way too much time looking for it. There was another show that Pam Grier was in called Foxy Brown, I think that was a movie. It was not the same thing, but this was, I think you could say charitably, an homage. But that, of course, got me thinking about Samuel Jackson in Shaft, you know, that movie that he made in the early 2000s, which, of course, he didn't. It was made in 2019. Time is a flat circle.
No, he did. He made one in 2000 in the early 2000s.
Where was that?
The 2019, it's the next version of it where his son is now Shaft.
Yes, and his dad is Richard Roundtree, right? And they're doing the three generations.
But there was the one in early 2000s where he returned to the character with Christian Bale as the, I think, his nemesis in that one.
That's right. Okay, good. So I'm not entirely crazy about that. I just got so stuck in watching clips of Richard Roundtree and his son, anyway, that I got myself very, very confused.
Yeah, John Singleton directed that one.
That's right. Good. Oh, thank goodness, Andy, you've redeemed my feeble brain a little bit. Anyway, the whole relationship and Samuel Jackson being able to do all of the stuff that Samuel Jackson does in this movie, like from the over the top to the subtle to the, I mean, over the top. And the fact that we get a Robert De Niro performance that is perhaps the most understated Robert De Niro performance until The Irishman. Like, it is, it's really interesting to see just how metered his performance is until he goes crazy. And even when he goes crazy, he's incredibly low key about his craziness. I love Robert De Niro in this movie. Like, he is a dim star, but shining nonetheless in this movie.
It's an interesting turn for De Niro, because he's played so many thieves and criminals, and like there's been a lot of that in his life, but rarely do you get one that is kind of the post-prison stoner who isn't really in a place where he's kind of getting anything together, and it just feels so lost. And it's kind of like the exact opposite for him of his character in Heat, who is so focused and so attuned to the job and ready to go. And this one is not that, and he isn't making any decisions for himself. He's hanging out with Ordell because he's just like nothing else to do, and he's just staying with Sharonda and just hoping that Ordell will help him with a gig, and here it comes. And it's such a shift in a role for him. And it took me, I remember watching this the first time, and I didn't like De Niro initially. I was like, this just, it feels like he wanted to be in a Tarantino film and he got cast in the wrong role. But over time, I've really grown to appreciate that it just feels like the complete opposite criminal that he's played so many other times. And that's what I really enjoy about him here.
Yeah. Oh, me too. I mean, I think he is. It's weird that he stands out so much for being a character that is a small character and doesn't actually stand out all that much. I think he's really terrific. We also have Bridget Fonda as in another, like, it, because they're sort of paired in terms of screen time, Robert De Niro and Bridget Fonda's roles. I think they're also very interesting people. Fonda is the, I don't remember what Jackson calls her, the Daffy Blonde,
his little surfer girl,
right? And so she just hangs out, and her aspirations are to watch TV and get high, and I think that's really delightful. And she plays it. Doesn't give her a lot to chew on, but she plays it.
But she's got the anger and everything. I think there's a fun character in here of this. This stoner chick who is a beach bunny and just is looking for some guy to basically be her little sugar daddy, who's going to give her the place to live in so that basically she can sit around and get high and watch TV, which is basically her life ambition. And of course, she ends up screwing Lewis, and it's just like it's a very funny moment, because it's all of like 3 minutes. They have that quick sex and then everything's normal again. And then the way that the relationship continues, and her relationship with Ordell really kind of continues to evolve once she's thrust into this situation, this robbery that she wants no part of. And you can see how much she hates it and how she's acting out the whole time. And that's what I love about her character, is just like she continues to push and act out. And when she starts finding that she can really needle Lewis, like it is just so enjoyable to watch her just pissing De Niro off. And when he stops, there's that moment where she's saying something and he just stops and looks at her and gives her that like cold De Niro stare. It's like, as a performer opposite that, I would just stop in my tracks too.
Yeah,
like right. That would just be a hard thing to work against, because it's that, like, so 100% frightening.
Is why you hire De Niro for this role, is that look, yeah. Right? That 1-2 second look.
Yep.
Totally agree. And when he stops and shoots her, he tells her, if you open your mouth again, I'm going to shoot you. Which, of course, you know, okay, people sometimes say, oh, okay, you're talking too much. Oh, I shoot you. And they don't really mean it. And then he turns around and shoots her. It's the ultimate sort of gag that makes that kind of violence set up as funny. And that's a Tarantinoism, right? To make that stuff funny. And the fact that De Niro keeps on with the conversation after she's dead is... again, super Tarantino.
Well, and even to the point where when Lewis picks up Ordell and he's just like, why didn't you just hit her? And he's just like, I guess I could have, but like, it continues. And it's, you know, the whole conversation of violence against women and all this sort of stuff, but still, terrible. It's just, it plays so funny listening to the two of them debating like how he could have handled that situation better. It's when he's just left her and he's like, well, is she dead? He's like, I don't know, maybe. And you know, it's like that whole conversation. So it's just, it plays so well. And that's, I think, one of the fun things, like the women that Ordell has in his life are so different. Like they're all such different beings, you know, Bridget Fonda as his blonde little surfer girl, and then Sharonda. And then you have, I'm forgetting the other one's names. The one who is, the heroin addict who looks terrible and is the one who is.
That was Sharonda, Lisa Gay Hamilton.
Yeah. And that's the house that he's staying at. And she's the mess.
Simone was Hattie Winston. She was the dancer.
Yeah, Simone is the dancer. You're right. Right. Sharonda is the one who's just sitting there totally passed out and gone when Max comes over to talk to Ordell later.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting set of women. And it also sets up a very frightening picture about how these sorts of situations are created. You know, we have him talking about how he found Sharonda. Oh, she just got off the bus from... I can't remember where, Kentucky or something. And, you know, and he was lost and he picked her up and basically probably got her hooked on heroin and set her up in a place. And now she works as a little courier or whatever when he needs somebody, you know?
Right.
It's kind of a frightening portrayal.
And the fact that he lied to her and took her to Compton and told her it was Hollywood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. And terrible. Terrible.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Before we get to... one of the great revival performances. I want to talk about Michael Keaton because I'd totally forgotten he was even in this movie. It's been just long enough since I saw it. I'd totally forgotten he was in it until he showed up. And what a weird surprise.
Weird because why?
It's weird because of all of the performers in here. It seems like the smallest part for this face that I see as like, why did Keaton take this part? I think he's great in it. It just surprised me to see his face in this part.
What's interesting there is like he, unlike De Niro, when I first saw this movie, Keaton felt so natural in the role of this ATF agent. Like it fit so perfectly for him. And it was kind of exciting to see that he worked so well in a Tarantino film. Because you're right, like some people, you're like, I wonder how they're going to fit into a Tarantino film. You know, how is that going to work? Because Tarantino has such a very particular vibe and everything. And we had seen what Keaton could do in things. Like, I mean, he had a lot of serious movies, a lot of comedy movies, kind of a whole map. He has his crazy performances like Beetlejuice and Much Ado About Nothing. And so it's like, okay, so what is he going to be bringing into a Tarantino film? And it's just like playing that tough ATF agent is just smart. And like the standout moment for me is when he's talking to Jackie and feels kind of sure that she probably is doing something. And just the way that it's like all the evidence points against her having done anything. Like she set up this whole crime so effectively that everything seems to be pointing away from her, but he's just so smart enough to just like, I sure hope that you're not doing anything stupid here. Like the way that he catches on, but he can't quite figure it out. And I think that that's such an interesting scene to kind of play.
So he was, he had done Multiplicity the year before, which I know is one of your very favorite Five Star Heart movies.
Yeesh.
Oh, yeah. Also that. And I think of this, it's interesting, this period of his work as being some movies that were not kind of up to the standard of Michael Keaton. And yet, you know, when you look at Time is the Flat Circle, like they all blend together, and it's as if he just, as soon as he lost his hair, he's the same guy everywhere, right? As soon as he goes to that look.
Well, it is interesting because it really seemed to be hitting a point in his career where his leading role status was shifting away from him in bigger successful films. Like after Multiplicity, it really is like everything that he was doing after that, it kind of starts falling into less popular films like Jack Frost and a lot of more supporting roles and stuff like that. And it really, like, he kind of faded quite a bit. And it really wasn't until Birdman in 2014 that really kind of reminded everybody how great he can be as a leading man. And we started seeing more interesting films from him. Now, again, it fluctuates, but it's just been exciting to kind of see him have that resurgence. Yeah.
But fluctuates. I mean, Spotlight, I know I didn't like that movie, but the Body Politic loved it. The Founder, right? That was a really fun turn for him. You know, I think the Spider-Man Homecoming, he's got Adrian Toomes voice. The challenge is stuff like American Assassin. That's the fluctuate,
yeah,
I guess.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I just think he's such an interesting guy. I'm so in the bag for Michael Keaton. It was a real joy to see him, you know, show up in this movie. It was almost as much of a joy as the joy of being spoiled that he's going to return to his Batman in The Flash. Like, that was the best part of The Flash, was just seeing Michael Keaton. Like, they played me. I was played, and I enjoyed it. And so those little surprise nods, I think, were really great. And I thought their relationship in this movie, I think you're absolutely right, like talking about how eager he was to just like be successful and figure this out. And as the heist kind of starts revolving around him in the mall at the end, I thought it was really fun, like watching him just try to keep up. He plays it really, really well.
Yeah, no, he's great in it.
So I know you're looking forward to talking about this particular character. I know this was the big revival that you were looking forward to. Would you like to do a tight five on your love of Chris Tucker?
It's very funny seeing him pop up here. This was definitely the Friday period for him before, you know, things shifted in his focus later in his life. I do enjoy him in this, in his one role, and it feels very much akin to Friday. If that character ever got off the porch and stopped smoking weed and went into a life of crime, perhaps this is where he would have ended up.
He does. He moves from drugs to guns.
Yeah.
All right. So for real, Robert Forster.
He was one of those people who popped up in this, and I hadn't remembered seeing him in stuff before. Although clearly when I went back and looked at other movies that he had been part of in his long career, I'm like, oh, okay, I had seen other things before. It was kind of fun to go, okay, oh, I do remember him in The Black Hole now, or Alligator, you know, those sorts of things. And so it was kind of fun to see him pop up as somebody who was, you know, at this point, it kind of gave him a nice little career resurgence that was able to kind of give him more options to do for the next, you know, couple decades before we sadly lost him in 2019.
I know. It's weird to think that we really just lost him, seems like a few years ago. For me, he was, it's weird to say, but he was in Heroes, the series, and every time he would show up, he played this, you know, sort of billionaire industrialist shadow character, father figure to horribleness. And I think he was great. When I saw him show up in this as like a normal guy who wears polo shirts, I thought, this is very strange. But my goodness, does this guy have a career? 190 credits, like crazy deep career, you know, that he's got behind him, and wrapped up on a part on Better Call Saul. He did an episode. He was in El Camino, the Breaking Bad movie. And so, you know, it's fun to see all those worlds kind of collide.
Yeah.
He was great in this movie, right? He was a really interesting part. I guess, I don't know that they ever say it out loud. Was he was an ex-cop? Is that what you get?
I don't know. In my thinking, my assumption just of that career is that it takes somebody who probably had worked in law enforcement to kind of make that shift into working as a bail bondsman. So I don't know if they actually call that out. And again, I haven't read Rum Punch, so I can't speak to that. But it certainly, I had that impression.
I think it's such an interesting thing, like watching him make the turn through many conversations with Ordell and with Jackie, that, you know, as he's making the turn from doing what he's doing to realizing that he can't do what he's doing forever, and that maybe his sense of justice, his spectrum of justice is fluid, and that he's willing to make this particular turn and partake in this particular bit of thievery, was awesome. And he ends up being so subtle for a guy who's done some very big performances. He's actually really, really subtle and an elegant kind of performer.
And that's what's so interesting about it. And I'm glad you used the word elegant, because there's something about this character who, I mean, he's just a bail bondsman. There's nothing really exciting about that role. Apologies to any bail bondsmen who are listening, but it just feels like he brings this elegance to even that career. Just, you know, it's kind of just this simple way of just handling everything, and just very calm and always collected, even when he's being confronted by or tested, pushed by Ordell in some of their conversations. The way he handles it is just, it's always so effortless. And I enjoy that so much about watching him.
And equally fun to see Tom Lister as his partner.
Tiny.
Especially when you talk about the Friday days, right? Like to have Tom Lister and Chris Tucker in the same movie.
Yeah, that was kind of funny. Yeah, very small role, but it was fun to see him in here.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Well, we haven't spent much time yet talking about Pam Grier as our lead.
Okay.
Had you seen any Pam Grier films? What was your experience with her as a performer leading up to this?
Well, I mean, not really. I had not seen, I knew that she had done so many of the sort of blaxploitation films and had a real vibe for the era.
I'd probably seen her in, like, she played a part in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, Ms. Wardrow, but I wouldn't have been able to probably tell you when I saw it, oh, that's Pam Grier. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, she's, same, like Something Wicked This Way Comes, same thing there. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. And so, you know, seeing her in this movie, I didn't have a real connection to what the movie was trying to do, and until much, much later. And I think that, you know, her sensibility as a performer and her sort of, you talk about Forster's class and elegance, like, she is such a patient actor. I mean, her presence on screen is calming, right? Like, she feels calming to me. And I can totally see why I would get that same vibe from her when they cast her in Bless This Mess, the TV show that was a very short run, 2-season TV show in 2019 that was one of our favorites as a family. And she played this wizened sheriff that was so calm and so cool and so level-headed and gentle. And it reminded me of how great she was in this movie, even when she is being pulled aside by, you know, in the parking garage, the first time she gets her bag searched by Keaton and Michael Bowen. She is so sort of gentle about the whole thing. And I think that's something that this part does really well. It shows, like, here's somebody who's under a lot of pressure and is maintaining their complete sense of stability and grounding. And I think that's one of the things that's so great about this movie. All the characters in senses of in positions of stress demonstrate a bit of cool that makes this exciting as someone who would not be cool in the same situation watching it, right? Like, I know I don't remember the last time you got pulled over for money laundering and international espionage.
Yesterday, but we don't need
you that. Are very chill in those situations. I don't think I would be.
She brings so much to it. And one of my favorite scenes between her and Max is the conversation where they're talking about just being getting older and kind of like that fear of getting older and not knowing what to do and not knowing if something happens and I'm left with nothing. Like, that scares me more than Ordell, you know, just like that conversation is just such an interesting one that I think gives so much to these two characters and the developing relationship that they have.
When you think about the romance, though, like there is a building romance until that is so patient until the very end of the movie, right? After all of the hullabaloo and all of the money is in the right place, and then she shows up in the bail bonds office, and they have that moment together. And she walks up to him and he stands up leaning next to the desk and she leans in. And I think that scene, maybe even that cut, that is one of the best in the film, when we get to see in that frame as it pushes in on their kiss, we get to see all of the pent up relationship that had been building throughout the movie. And it just places itself in front of us. It's not an engrossing love film or love scene. It's not a sex scene. It's not gratuitous. It is a first kiss. And I think that is incredibly special in a movie like this. It is incredibly special that Tarantino directed a first kiss with as much heart in it as he did.
With so much heart and longing and that sense of understanding between the two of them that while there may be hope that there's could be something more, there's already that aged wisdom that this likely is going to be it. It's to that end, it also ends up kind of full of heartbreak. And it's just like such a great, great moment to have in this film,
yeah,
between these two.
Oh, and we get a Forster turn when he picks up the phone and says, "Can I call you back in a half hour?" Right? Or "Can you call me back in a half hour?" And the reason is not because they're going to have a sex scene in the bail bonds office.
He's going to run after her.
He just needs a half hour to be sad. Oh, my God. It's amazing. It is amazing and so real.
And
right?
then he walks so off into out of focus. Like the way that the camera, the shallow depth of field were with him up close. And he walks back deep into the office and the camera doesn't. Rack focus with him. It just lets him drift out of focus. And it's like, will he ever actually leave this job? Who knows? But it was kind of like a moment that had been presented to him. And he's at a point where he, you know, maybe running off with a criminal who's just stolen $500,000 to Spain may not be the right choice, but it sure was the choice his heart wanted, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the scene for me in this movie. There's a lot going on in the movie, but giving those two a chance to let a relationship breathe for 60 seconds as the movie ends was a very special choice.
And then ending the film on her as she's just looking into camera as she's driving and just kind of mouthing the words to Across 110th Street, which is what started the film. And we just have her melancholy, thrilled with the idea of where she's going to be going, but this kind of also has this sense of loss and heartbreak. And it just, I mean, it's just such a wonderful, wonderful way to wrap this story up.
Pivoting just a little bit to Tarantino and some of these choices, like so much of Tarantino's vibe is deals in, I think, the mashup of retro and modern sensibilities. And I would love your take on how you think he does with that particular aesthetic in this movie. It feels very much to be an homage to the 70s, to these blaxploitation films, from the typography of the credits to, you know, to the music choices and all of those things. And yet here we are with cell phones.
It's definitely a story of its day. And to that end, he still felt he wanted to pay this homage to Pam Grier and this world of films that she had been in the 70s with Coffee and Foxy Brown. And I mean, even to the point where the titling for Jackie Brown is the same titling they used in Foxy Brown. He's pulling some songs from those movies and just the looks and everything. It just feels very much of that same world that we have in those films. But it's also a Tarantino film, as you said, and he's giving us a story that feels very much of the way that he chooses to craft stories. And he's pulling stuff from all over the place, like that opening walk that we have, or it's not even a walk. It's just her floating, essentially, up against this tile backdrop in an airport is straight out of The Graduate, of the opening credits of The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman kind of floating through the airport with Simon and Garfunkel drifting behind. It's this sense of drifting. And so his language of cinema pulls from so many different sources. And having that start the film off definitely gives us an impression of the type of character that Jackie is. We're getting a sense of her kind of floating through life and having made these mistakes and just kind of like trying to hold things together so that, you know, she can keep moving. Then just how Tarantino also understands all of the tools, the cinematic tools that he has at his disposal and how he chooses to use them. I talked about that a little bit earlier, like the slow push in on Samuel L. Jackson's face as he's thinking and piecing things together. Like, you just don't see that very often. But another thing that I love is in one of our Movies We Like episodes, we had a sound recordist on, Mike Coffey, and talking about how frustrating it is for him when he's watching a movie and the sound obviously shouldn't be all playing that close to camera if the characters are far away from camera. And Tarantino, like, is a great example of doing that effectively. And I really enjoy the scene when Ordell finally convinces Chris Tucker's character to get into the trunk. And you've got him hopping in the car, playing the music, and the music is playing like our soundtrack. And then he drives away, and the soundtrack drives off with him, and it gets quieter and quieter. And then what I love just about the way that Tarantino constructed all of this is the camera is on a boom and you kind of get this slow pan over, and then suddenly the camera just goes higher and higher and higher, and it reveals that all Ordell does is drive around behind the fence into an opening into this dirt parking lot where there's like an oil rig. And now we're in this incredibly high, wide shot of Ordell as he climbs out of the car, opens the trunk, shoots Beaumont two times, hops back in, and drives away. And the soundtrack shifts with us. It's all done in a single shot. And finding those moments throughout a film where we don't have to have it all put together in all these cuts, like that takes a lot of filmmaking prowess to understand what will work and how can you move the camera to keep this alive. And it's, I don't know, it was very funny watching this film. We've, you know, for our member bonus episode for February, we're talking about Spawn. Curse all the members for voting on that one. But it was very funny to see that that film was shot by Guillermo Navarro. And then at the beginning of this, I'm like, oh, how funny. Another Guillermo Navarro film. How different a film looks when a cinematographer has a director who really understands how to put a film together and does it so effectively.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty funny. I thought that was pretty funny. We have a couple of back-to-backs, right? Because we also have Sam Jackson and Yves Bayou last week. Like, that's really, it's really a funny back-to-back bit. I think what's interesting about the time to me is I'm listening to you talk about, you know, all of these tools and the mashup that is, you know, Quentin Tarantino, that in many ways, as much as this is a movie that is spiritually set in the 70s and practically set in a more modern time, that mashup makes the movie sort of timeless. Like, watching the movie does not feel dated at all to me, right? Like, there's nothing that necessarily feels like it couldn't have been made right now. It is sophisticated filmmaking. It's sophisticated techniques behind the camera. It's incredible use of light and shadow and really playing with sources, single light source lit scenes, like things that just are made incredibly dramatic, but it doesn't feel necessarily like a 70s film, nor does it feel like a 90s film. It just feels like a great film.
Yeah, like you bring up the lighting example when Ordell shows up at Jackie's after she's been bailed out, and the whole scene, the way that it plays with light,
yeah,
as they keep turning, he turns it off and she turns it back on, and it's building the tension of, like, is he here to kill her? What's going on? And also paired with that, again, this is Tarantino understanding when great filmmakers like Brian De Palma really love to play with split screen. How do you do it well? This was a great example, because we're seeing on one half, we're just following Max driving home, and we're like, okay, I don't understand why I'm watching this while I'm also watching Jackie and Ordell in her apartment. And then as he pulls in and he opens the glove box and sees that his gun that we had seen was already in there, it's now gone. And then we go full screen, and that's when it's like we get the reveal that Jackie has the gun and she pulls it on Ordell. It's like smart, interesting filmmaking.
Oh, so good. And I think I had that halogen light.
The one that, as it dims, it just
turning
out,
on and off.
Like, it really buzzes. Yeah. I feel like everybody had that light in the late 90s.
That was a light of an era, for sure. Yes, I guess that light may have dated the movie for me, I guess. I guess I'm wrong about everything. Yeah. Speaking of time and cutting, like, you bring up that use of split screen, which is, I think, really cool. The end of the movie, we end up getting a little bit of the cut, replay kind of, you know, the Rashomon stuff.
Yeah, very much like The Killing.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. How does that work for you in terms of the unveiling of the heist in action?
We'd already established a lot of the subtitles popping up throughout, giving us like where we were in LA, which was kind of fun because it's a lot of it is so specific. It's just like that, as somebody not from LA, I don't know where that is, but it's nice to feel so specific, all these little towns and everything.
I feel connected.
Yeah. And we start getting that with the times late in the film as everybody starts moving in. And you really got to be paying attention to note that the time jumps backward. And that's when suddenly you're like, oh, okay, now I'm following Lewis and Mel as they're now going into the mall and she's running late and all this sort of stuff. And so he's already kind of flustered. And you get to start seeing all of these pieces come together. And what's great about like that one, we first see Jackie go through the motions and you don't necessarily catch everybody else in motion at the same time. But once you see Mel and Lewis come through, if you're watching, the camera passes Max as he's standing there in the ladies' garments. And if you're not paying attention, you might miss it, but he's standing there. And so you're slowly putting all these puzzle pieces together. We've had bits and pieces of the conversations as Jackie had been talking to Max. And then that's what else Tarantino starts doing, is he starts having those conversations between the two of them days before, or the night before, I'm not exactly sure, but you're getting those conversations as she's kind of explaining it. It's very Ocean's 11, and this is what makes some heist films so exciting, is when they start setting up all these different pieces, and you're just trying to put the puzzle together and hope that you can get to the place where they are before them. But inevitably, what makes them always great is when they get there before you, and it just is like, oh my God, that was so interesting, you know. And I love the way that when Robert Forster walks out with the bag and he's just like, huh, what do you know? Like,
right. Like, it feels like they were setting us up for a fail. Like, I felt like Robert Forster at the end because I thought they'd already missed the boat. I couldn't remember that there was another part of the plan, that Forster was there for a reason. And I think it was, it ends up being like, this is Tarantino also making a Soderbergh movie, right? You bring up Oceans. It's also making a Christopher Nolan movie. Like, so many of these tropes of working with time, Tarantino actually nails really well, expertly in revealing the layers through camera and time that we need to put the pieces together in a way that is satisfying. There is nothing in this movie that I don't feel good about at the end as I'm retracing the steps in my mind of what I just went through. There's nothing that doesn't feel satisfying.
You know, there's the potential hiccup that we have there with Lewis seeing Max in the ladies' garments. And that is potentially the one thing that could really throw a wrench into the things. And it is. I mean, when he's sitting there in the car with Ordell, that's the one thing that he's just like, oh, you know, it was weird, I didn't think of it, but Max was there. And that's like the puzzle piece that Ordell needed to start weaving everything through to figure out, okay, so Jackie is the one behind all this. But again, even with all of that, that helps build everything to that final confrontation that Jackie sets up with Ray and his partner in the kind of just, you know, hiding in the closet basically at Max's office. And there's what's so interesting is like that always throws me. And I just think in a film like this, it's so interesting when characters are telling the truth and you're like, wait a minute, like she's telling all of the quote secrets with the cops and everything to Ordell. She's telling all of Ordell's secrets to the cops. Like everybody seems to know everything. And that's where it's so interesting because so much of it is known by so many of the players. It's all those little tiny pieces that we don't know that Jackie's really weaving that actually makes everything come together perfectly.
Well, weaving, and the last key point that I think maybe if this had been a Soderbergh, at some point cut out in some other part of the linearity of the film, we would have seen Forster's hands putting money in a cardboard box. Because the last sort of drop is when she's at the pawnbroker and says, you know, I received the money you mailed me, the $500,000 that he had mailed. And that was something we didn't know. Like there was, my assumption was that the money had been still in the safe at the bonds office, but it wasn't. It wasn't even there, which was, that was like that thoughtful, you know, icing on the cake.
Yeah, right.
I can also see how someone might watch that and think, well, it feels like such a small thing, but that's a thing that wasn't set up and might be something to complain about. That is not so for me.
Yeah.
Oh, what a movie.
Where do you stand with Elmore Leonard?
Well, we've talked about some Elmore Leonard stuff. Did we do Get Shorty?
Oh, we have not done Get Shorty.
Oh, well, we should. Out of Sight.
We haven't talked about Out of Sight.
No, but I mean, I'm going through books.
Yeah. And we also weirdly haven't talked about 310 to Yuma.
Yeah.
In our movies and their remakes. Both of those are such fantastic films. And that's one of his early short stories that was, I think, just an exceptional one. But yeah, I don't know if we've talked about too much of him. And I have read very little of him. I think I've read the short story of 310 to Yuma. That might be it.
I pretty much read the the books of the movies that I loved as they came out. So I did read Get Shorty. I did not read Be Cool. I also read the short story of 310 to Yuma. So not very many, actually. I guess I'm in the same boat as you are. I have not read as many as I had in my head. He's written a lot of books.
I think I've seen more of the films that he worked on as a writer, like a screenwriter, like Joe Kidd, Mr. Majestic, 52 Pickup. I think that's more... I guess even there, it's like, okay, I've seen a few of those movies. I've read very few of his books, but I've seen a few of the adaptations. And generally, I enjoy what he's doing. I enjoy the vibe that Elmer Leonard has.
Yeah, me too. I want to read, this is a strange one because he wrote Rylan, which was the book. I don't even know how this works. I was a big fan of Justified, the TV show. And this is the novel that is based on the series Justified, which was in turn based on Leonard's short story, Fire in the Hole. So that was a real snake eating its tail on that one. But I am curious about it because I was such a fan of the show that makes me want to jump back and check that out. At least the short story. I never read the short story.
Tarantino obviously is a fan. After Pulp Fiction, he and Roger Avery got the rights to Rum Punch, which is this is what this is based on, Freaky Deaky and Kill Shot. This was actually not the one he wanted to make. He wanted to do either Freaky Deaky or Kill Shot and have a different director do Rum Punch. But then he reread it and changed his mind. And as he said, quote, fell in love with the novel all over again. Lawrence Bender, who produced this, ended up in 2008 doing the adaptation of Kill Shot. I don't think Freaky Deaky has been adapted. And obviously, there were a lot of Tarantino changes with it. Like in the novel Rum Punch, it was not Jackie Brown, it was Jackie Burke. So he kind of changed it all, made her into an African American, and moved it. I think the novel took place in Florida. So there were a lot of changes made. But interestingly, Elmer Leonard says that of the 26 screen adaptations of his novels and shorts, this is possibly the best screenplay he'd ever read. He just loved it.
What is the connection between this one and the movie Out of Sight?
You know, it's an interesting connection because, again, based on one of his novels, Ray Nicolette, the ATF agent, is also in the novel. And Soderbergh, I think, who was adapting Out of Sight, was really smart in that, and he wanted to see who Tarantino was going to cast as Nicolette. Miramax had the right to the character, but Tarantino insisted that they not charge Universal to use the same character in Out of Sight. And Michael Keaton agreed to play uncredited in one scene in Out of Sight as the same character. And that's the sort of like filmmaking camaraderie that I enjoy when they actually come together and they're not, you know, being stingy and money grubbing about little things like this.
I think that's just such a fun way to make movies. Yeah. I just love those. It's when Keaton becomes an Easter egg.
Right, exactly. You know, one of the biggest controversies that erupted with this film is the use of the N-word, which was up until this point. I mean, I know it was Tarantino's third film. It wasn't that much, but the most he had used in a film. It was used 38 times in this film. He ended up using it more in Django Unchained and Hateful Eight. He said, this is quote from Tarantino, "The minute any word has that much power, as far as I'm concerned, everyone on the planet should scream it. No word deserves that much power." And of course, all of this caused a lot of controversy. Spike Lee criticized the film and Tarantino and said, "I'm not against the word and I use it, but not excessively. And some people speak that way, but Quentin is infatuated with that word. What does he want to be made? An honorary black man? And he uses it in all his pictures, Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs. I want Quentin to know that all African Americans do not think that word is trendy or slick." It really did kind of create this conversation touch point for quite a while that I think still is brought up every time another Tarantino film comes out, because people are like, how many times is he using the N-word in this film? I think that can be a tricky thing. It is a tricky element to hear being used so much, but it's a hard argument because I know that there are ways to see it both ways.
I struggle with it because, you know, he uses it a lot, but he uses it in terms of world building with characters that are using it believably.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, it feels to me like he's staying in world. He's not, like, giving that word to, you know, a bunch of white characters to just use without any sort of cultural comeuppance, right? Like, he's using it with in the right mouths, in the right actors and the right characters. And so I get it. Like, I get the cultural sensitivity to it, but I also find, like, it's not great to just be afraid of words. And there is something to Tarantino's argument of, like, let's maybe not give that word quite so much power, his perspective. I can see where he comes from there, and I can, but I'm on the side of, I think when Tarantino writes that word, it's in his style and it's used judiciously with the characters that he believes need to be using it.
Yeah, it's always a tricky line, but I can see the argument on both sides. So, well, I mean, is that about it?
Yeah. What else you got? I mean, you know, this is your number one favorite Quentin Tarantino movie. I mean, surely.
Well, I feel like we certainly covered the gamut. So with that, I guess we'll be right back. But first, our credits.
The Next Reel is a production of True Story FM, engineering by Andy Nelson, music by The Magnetic Buzz, Oriole Novella, and Eli Catlin. Andy usually finds the stats for the awards and numbers at d-numbers.com, boxofficemojo.com, imdb.com, and wikipedia.org. Find the show at truestory.fm, and if your podcast app allows ratings and reviews, please consider doing that for our show. Andy, can you believe we've almost hit 700 episodes of The Next Reel?
I know, it's crazy. And with all the other episodes in our family of podcasts, we are well over 1,200 episodes of movie conversation. It's really pretty amazing that we've gotten to have these in-depth movie chats every week for over a decade now.
And we couldn't have done it without our loyal community of film fans. Their support over the years has meant so much.
For sure. That reminds me, we should give the merch store a shout-out. Buying shirts from thenextreel.com/merch is a great way listeners can continue to support the show. Plus, they get to sport our great designs.
Absolutely. I think sometimes folks forget we have a variety of shirts, mugs, phone cases, and more available. In fact, a great place to start is with a shirt sporting the Next Reel's logo.
We also have that classic Fast Times Spicoli Surf School tee, or the weirdly popular Rusty's European Tour shirt.
The one from National Lampoon's European Vacation. Why is that so popular?
Search me, but we have sold a ridiculous number of those. I guess there are a lot of Rusty's taking trips to Europe?
We're always adding new designs based on movies we've covered, like our brand new design for A Streetcar Named Desire, featuring a streetcar named Desire. So if you want to rep your love of TNR and films, head to thenextreel.com/merch.
Every purchase helps us continue to have these weekly in-depth conversations. So visit thenextreel.com/merch today.
And as always, thanks for listening and being a part of the Next Reel community. We've got lots more great movie chats coming your way. Award season, Andy, how'd it do? Did it win lots of gold trophies?
It was a popular one. 9 wins with 24 other nominations for the film. At the Oscars, Robert Forster was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, but lost to Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting. Pam Grier did not. I know we're going to talk about her in the scope of the awards, but I mean, where do you stand with her performance? Award worthy here?
Yes, absolutely. I think so. I think the trouble is that Contact and Jackie Brown are very different movies.
Well, okay. So here's a question: in the Oscars, Best Actress in a Leading Role, Helen Hunt wins for As Good as It Gets, Helena Bonham Carter in The Wings of the Dove, Judi Dench in Mrs. Brown, Julie Christie in Afterglow, and Kate Winslet in Titanic.
Yeah. I
I haven't seen Afterglow, so I can't speak to Julie Christie's performance.
Yeah, but oh my goodness. Like, it, Pam Grier not to be nominated? It seems crazy to me.
I don't remember The Wings of the Dove well enough to say whether Helena Bonham Carter would be the one I would pull out or not. I'm fine with Helen Hunt in As Good as It Gets. I loved her in that. Judi Dench was fantastic in Mrs. Brown. She probably would actually have been my pick of the bunch. And Kate Winslet in Titanic. I mean, I think that's a strong one. It's a tricky one. I feel like it would either be Helena Bonham Carter or Julie Christie I'd pull out for this. But again, I need to watch those films again and compare.
Yeah. But here's an example, though, of all of the nominee. Did I miss one that was a nominee of color?
There weren't any.
There weren't any. There are like when you see Oscars So White, this is one of the data points, right? Because Pam Grier gave an incredible career defining performance in this movie, subtle and beautiful, and was not even nominated.
Yeah. This was still the period where it was Oscars So British, where it was all the British women who would get nominated, but the one American, this is like the big controversy when Marissa Tomei won. It's like, right. Oh, all these great British performances, but of course they have to give it to the American. But of course, Marissa Tomei has certainly proved her strength. And I think people now go, okay, yeah, okay, we'll give her that. But it's the same situation. You know, it's a tricky one. But, it's also a Barbie situation where it's like, it's Jackie Brown's film, but the supporting actor is the one who gets the nomination.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, and then I already sort of gave away. I was looking at Contact for the Saturn Awards.
Yeah, you were jumping ahead. But yeah, Saturn Awards, which I put a bunch of question marks here. It's like Saturn Awards, science fiction, fantasy, and horror. This gets nominated in the Saturn Awards. Pam Grier, Best Actress, lost to Jodie Foster in Contact. And Robert Forster got nominated for Best Supporting Actor, but lost to Vincent D'Onofrio in Men in Black. Yeah, because those are actual science fiction fantasy right. Horror genre films like this.
That would be why.
I mean, this is a crime thriller. I guess it's genre enough where the Saturn Awards say sure, but it seems strange to me.
Yeah, to me too.
At the SAG Awards, Pam Grier was nominated for Best Actress, but lost to Helen Hunt in As Good as It Gets. At the MTV Movie Awards, Best Male Performance, Samuel L. Jackson, but lost to Leonardo DiCaprio in Titanic. And of course, the reason we're here, last but not least, the NAACP Image Awards, Outstanding Female Lead. Pam Grier was nominated, but lost to Vanessa Williams in Soul Food.
I can't comment on Soul Food yet. We haven't watched it yet. It's like it doesn't exist until we've watched it.
I haven't seen it since the theaters, so I'm looking forward to jumping into that one again.
It's one of those that I don't have a strong memory of. Like, it'd be hard-pressed to tell you what happens. It's been so long. Yeah. It was a surprise to me when it hit our list as a movie to talk about.
Couple more movies, then it'll be here.
How to do with the box office.
Well, for Tarantino's third film, he had a budget of $12 million, or $23.6 million in today's dollars. His biggest budget so far. The movie had a Christmas opening, December 25th, 1997. Anyone remember the movie poster saying, "This Christmas, Santa's got a brand new bag with the money bag on it"? That's right. On a typically busy holiday opening. You ready for this? It opened opposite Titanic, Tomorrow Never Dies, Mouse Hunt, As Good as It Gets, An American Werewolf in Paris, The Postman, Mr. Magoo, and limited releases of Wag the Dog, Kundun, and The Winter Guest. That is insane. That is just an insane lineup of holiday movies.
Wow.
Even with all that craziness, this still opened in fourth behind Titanic, Tomorrow Never Dies, and Scream 2. Still, it did not get the traction that Pulp Fiction had, only lasting in the top 20 for 4 weeks. This went on to earn almost $40 million domestically and $35 million internationally for a total gross of $147.2 million in today's dollars. Even if it wasn't as big a hit for Tarantino at the time, it still landed solidly with an adjusted profit per finished minute of $800,000, earning back more than six times its budget.
That's outstanding. Worth it.
Yeah.
Worth it.
It's a great one. I'm glad we got it on the list. I think that this particular film was one of those films that our members had said they'd really love us to chat about. And so as we were building our season, this was one that we built this season, I think, or this particular series around this movie.
Yeah, for sure. Great movie. I'm so glad we talked about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll be right back for our ratings. But first, here's the trailer for next week's movie, Theodore Witcher's Love Jones.
Negro, what are you doing here?
Let me buy you dinner.
Okay, the Billy D thing is a little played out, but I will give you 10 cool points for nostalgia's sake. I am not trying to meet another man at this time.
You and I should get together sometime and have a drink.
I don't think that'll be a very good idea.
Hey.
Persistence.
Be surprised how far I can get you.
Boom. Put it on. Why don't you meet a friend of mine, Tracy Powell?
Hi.
What?
You married.
Wait. If my memory serves me correctly, you were the one that told me not to get married.
I did say that, but I also said the Commodores would get back together. I mean, who knew?
What I need is to find a man who's not scared of my power.
Ladies, what's up?
I don't need poetry to get women.
No, you need a personality to get women.
Try a breath mint and a visa.
New Line Cinema presents...
We had a perfect date, and I just wanted to feel like I was saving something for later.
But baby, you ain't gotta say nothing for me. I mean, you know, I want mine now.
Sometimes a man just wanna be held, you know? Cuddled a little bit.
Please.
Lorenz Tate. Nia Long. Lisa Nicole Carson. Isaiah Washington. And Bill Bellamy.
I just wanna ask you, what type of underwear do you like?
In a film about making it.
All we ask is a little sex on demand. What kind of underwear do you have on?
I don't wear drawers.
You don't have any on right now.
Breaking it.
Wave goodbye to your daddy, baby.
And putting it all together.
This is nothing serious. This is not a love thing.
Love Jones.
Yes, it's for you.
Wait a minute. You made breakfast.
Directed by Theodore Witcher.
It is hard to believe we've been having in-depth weekly conversations about movies since 2011.
You're telling me producing this show week after week is so much fun, but it does require a lot of work behind the scenes. If you'd like to help support our efforts, one easy way is by using our Originals page when shopping for books and movies that we've covered.
Your purchases made through our links give us a small commission at no extra cost to you and allow us to keep having these great discussions.
The Originals page at thenextreel.com/originals links to the source material for all of our adapted film discussions. Purchasing through our links supports the show.
In season 13, we explore various awards categories and the films nominated in them.
We wrapped up our 1940 Best Picture series with adaptations of Mice and Men from John Steinbeck and Wuthering Heights from Emily Bronte's novel, not to mention the play Dark Victory by George Brewer Jr. and Bertram Block.
The 1947 Academy Award adapted screenplay series featured Anna and the King of Siam, based on Margaret Langdon's book, plus The Best Years of Our Lives, Brief Encounter, and The Killers.
The 1952 cinematography nominees included Death of a Salesman and A Streetcar Named Desire, A Place in the Sun, based on both a play and a book, and Strangers on a Train, based on Patricia Highsmith's first novel.
So many great movies based on books and plays, like Beckett, The Pumpkin Eater,
A Boy and His Dog, Rollerball,
The Princess Bride, Congo, The Scarlet Letter,
Jackie Brown, The Deep End, The Gray, The Woman in Black,
and Top Gun Maverick, which I'm very much looking forward to revisiting.
Get the source books at thenextreel.com/originals.
Start your next read or reread from the movies we've covered. Visit thenextreel.com/originals today. Letterboxd, Andy, letterboxd.com/thenextreel. That's where our HQ page is. Are there any surprises to this one? Like, it just feels like, is it two stars with some quibbles but a giant heart? Like, are you doing anything?
We talked about kind of star ratings in our pre-show chat for members, and I already revealed it's a 5-star and a heart. It's an easy one for me. There's really no surprises. I just think it's such an incredible Tarantino film in a career of so many incredible films. I really enjoy what he cranks out.
Me too. 5-star and a heart. Too easy. Too easy. What a great, great rewatch. So glad to have it on the list.
Yeah, absolutely. Remember, you can find The Next Reel on Letterboxd at The Next Reel. You can find me at Soda Creek Film, and you can find Pete at Pete Wright. So check us out. Follow us over there. So what did you think about Jackie Brown? We would love to hear your thoughts. Hop into the Show Talk channel over in our Discord community, where we will be talking about the movie this week.
When the movie ends,
our conversation begins.
Letterboxd giveth, Andrew.
As Letterboxd always doeth.
Mine has heart. It's sweet. It's not a joke. I'm telling you, there's no punchline.
Oh.
So if you have any humor to yours, I should go first.
You go first then.
Okay. Okay. Well, I know where you're going. All right. I have a 5-star from Philippe Furtado. I'm 56 years old. I can't blame anybody for anything I do. Quote from the movie. Just the most tired, resigned caper movie possible. So much love and care and how it is happy to just sit and watch all these people as it collects them along the way. There's very few bits on movies that get to me quite like when the camera goes out of focus on Forster when he goes back to cry in the end. That is a review that is just presents how glad I am that we're not the only ones who love that out of focus shot.
Yeah, it is so good.
All right, now give me your lowbrow humor.
Well, I went 3.5 and a heart by Maria, and I don't know if the typos are intentional or not, but it makes it that much funnier. Quentin Tarantulino sure does love feet. We didn't even talk about the Bridge of Fire, extreme close-up toe shots that we get, but yes.
Does that name belong on one of our shirts? Quentin Tarantulino.
Tarantulino. I'm just not even sure what's going on there.
Oh, that's awesome. I love it. I love it. Well, thanks, Letterboxd. I've been podcasting since 2006. In that time, I have tried countless hosting platforms, but in August 2022... we switched to Transistor to power all of our shows here at True Story FM, and it's been a game changer.
I love the Transistor allows unlimited podcasts and storage without extra charges. We can publish so much content, and we do. If you want to start up a podcast, do yourself a favor and host your show on Transistor.
With their one-click publishing, you can get your new show onto all the major podcast directories effortlessly.
And their website builder lets you quickly build custom sites for each show.
The detailed analytics are invaluable, too. You can access all kinds of listener data anytime.
Oh, and the versatile players allow you to embed episodes anywhere to reach new listeners. Plus, the team behind Transistor is super responsive and keeps making the platform even better.
After using countless hosting services over 15-plus years, Transistor has been hands down the best podcast partner for us.
If you want a hosting platform to take all the worry out of getting your podcast out into the world, go to thenextreel.com/transistor and check it out.
Support our show and support your own show by going to thenextreel.com/transistor. Start growing your podcast today.